we are beginning. This is, I think, year number 13, lucky number, on the making of modern Judaism. We're up to, we're still in the end of the 16th, beginning of the 17th century. We're up to the very prolific Bayit Chadash, the Bach as he's known, but Rav Yoel Sirkis. Which is why everyone always remembers his name, because it's a circus. But we'll find out a little bit about him. You cannot learn about the Bach without learning about the way the Bach paskin halacha, because that is his defining characteristic. About other Rabbanim, we know a lot more in terms of their communal actions, etc. From the Bach, we learn almost everything about him from his numerous shelot u'tshuvot, from his numerous responsa, as well as from his extraordinarily creative, bold, innovative, I don't know, all the words you can think of, or all the adjectives you could think of in terms of describing his commentary on the Torah. So let's just do a little bit of the background. So the Bach is living in an extraordinarily creative time in Poland. You have the forming of a community. He is the second or almost third generation after the kind of the great fathers of the rabbinic tradition there. So if the great fathers are the Rama, Rav Moshe Isserles, and the Maharshal, Rabbi Shlomo Luria, the Bach is the next or even next after generation after that. So he is dealing with this kind of very exciting and moving Polish community, which we've spoken about already numerous times. You have the Vad HaArba Arzos, the Council of the Four Lands, leading halachically and communally. You have some amazing rabbinic personalities. You have this massive kind of ideological wars going on. We've spoken about two of them, both of which the Bach is going to weigh in on. Ideological war number one is over codification, good or bad, whereas in the Sephardic community it seems to be embraced. In the Ashkenazic community it is immensely controversial. Even though now the Rama has really become standard, Rav Moshe Isserles has become standard as terms of the posek for Ashkenazi Jewry. At the time, in the early part of the 16th century, this was hotly debated, no more than by the Maharshal in his very extensive critiques and criticisms of codification. The Bach will weigh in on this subject. Number two, where the Bach will weigh in on is on the subject of what we spoke about last week when dealing with the Maharsha, the renewal of the Maimonidean controversy. There is the Maimonidean controversy specific as relating to the Rambam and his Sefer Mada and the use of philosophy in the book. But then there's a general question about whether philosophy is good or bad for the Jewish people. We saw that the Rama of Moshe Isserles was someone who is more inclined toward the study of philosophy. The Maharsha, Rabbi Shmuel Edels, was also someone more inclined to the study of philosophy. The Maharal was someone who, I guess, would be ambivalent about it, since there's numerous philosophical concepts within his work. However, he is not someone who is necessarily a proponent of it. And here the Bach will weigh in on this subject as well. And then there's a third issue, which isn't so much a philosophical statement, but a communal statement, which is the creation of responsa, or the authorship of responsa, which is growing and growing in this time with more of the practical issues relating to a fairly affluent Jewish community in Poland, a community which was growing in leaps and bounds, both in terms of money, in terms of influence, in terms of numerous opportunities that were given to the Jewish people in Eastern Europe that they had not had in a long time. And all these were creating new halachic issues and halachic problems, and they were being sent to people like the Bach. The Bach, you can see, one of the things that also seems to be common amongst many of the scholars of the time, they were men of great means. He was wealthy, he had a lot of money. And was able to support himself, but he still had rabbinical positions. He had a rabbinical position in Belz, he has a rabbinical position in Brest-Litovsk, and he has his final rabbinical position in Krakow, where he opens up a yeshiva, and he trains numerous people, among them Rabbeinu David the Taz, who ultimately becomes his son-in-law, and also one of the great Chachanim and commentators in Halacha. But we're going to leave the Taz, the Turei Zahav, his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, on the side for the most part right now, and focus only on the Bach. So one of the things that you find out about him, and I brought a number of his tshuvos and his comments here, one of the things you find out about the Bach is how, I neglected to say that the reason I call him the Bach is because of his primary work, which is called the Bayit Chadash. The Bayit Chadash is a commentary on the Tur, Rabbi Yaakov Balaturim, which was the second attempt, or maybe even the third attempt, at codification of Halacha. It was limited in scope and very focused in terms of the community it was relating to, and therefore it was redone in the form of the Shulchan Aruch. But the Bach, the Bayit Chadash, writes a commentary on the Tur in the wake of the Beit Yosef, in the wake of Rav Yosef Karo. It is not by chance that he is writing a commentary on the Tur. His goal is to bring the Tur's sources. His goal is also to be a counterweight to Rav Yosef Karo, who wanted to be the last word in Halacha, and the Bach was not going to allow that. So that was one thing that the Bach was attempting to do. The other thing is, if you've ever opened up your Vilna Shas, very often you will see on the page Hagaot Abach, the emendations of the Bayit Chadash of Rav Yol Sirkis. Why were they put in the Gemara? He had a keen eye for textual anomaly and for linguistics, both in Rashi, Tosfos, and the Gemara itself. And therefore, he made somewhat emendations in order to make the text read more clearly and flow more clearly in the Gemara, in Rashi, and in Tosfos. And those made it onto the Daf, considering that they were so significant in those times. And that's one of his kind of interesting pet peeves, was a focus on textual transmission. So let's deal with some of his bold halachic decisions. There's also some cultural points that are coming out of here. So number one is something near and dear to all of us, which is Mechiras Chametz, right? The sale of Chametz. We all know that every year, when it comes down to pre-Pesach, many people sell their Chametz. So back in the olden days, in Bachian times, back in the pre-modern age in Poland, and even before that, selling your Chametz meant literally selling your Chametz. You would put it in a big box. You would go over to your local non-Jew who you hoped you could trust, and you would sell him the box of chametz, delivering it to his house. Comes along the box time, and there's a new situation. Many Jews were involved in what industry? Wine. Liquor. Liquor and wine, right? More liquor than wine. Okay, and now you have these vast storehouses of, you know, J&B, I guess, or whatever it is that they were selling. Slivovitz, right? Well, Slivovitz is kosher Lepes Pesach, so it can't be Slivovitz. They have these vast storehouses of probably vodka or other forms of beer or whatever it is. And what are you? Okay, what do you say? Right, no, so I'm saying it's probably beer made with barley or oats. That's chametz. So here the Bach deals with this question of mechiras chametz and comes along the Bach and says as follows. This is the Bach in Or HaChaim Siman Taf Memchad. This is his commentary on the tour. So he says as follows. B'medina zo, in this town, Sherov Masa Matan B'yayin Saraf. That most of us, what do we deal in? We deal in booze and schnapps. It's impossible to actually pick up all the stuff and sell it to some non-Jew outside of your house. He says, and particularly people who have, I guess, they're these warehouses or these bars. He says, I want to give a heter now a permission, what? You can sell to the non-Jew all the chametz in the room. What can you do also? Rather than actually transferring it from hand to hand, you can allow the goy to use what's called the kinyan chatzer. Right, a kinyan chatzer is where your property buys something on your behalf. So you can physically sell the property on which the chametz is lying to the goy. And he says, Ella, rather, kevan de kaimalan de ein hagoy kone karka ella bishtar im netinas kesef. He says, since we hold what? That a goy can only buy land, that you needed to have a what? A shtar, you needed to have a contract, and there needs to be transference of money. Kidi isa beperakama de kedushin, as it says in the first perak of kedushin. He says, vitricha milsa lichtov shtar. Right, he says, but what's the problem? He says, it's a pain in the neck to have to write a contract just for 7 or 8 days. You know, what kind, you know, it's a pain in the neck. So he says, Vigam also, what's he going to say? Oh, I got a shtar. I've got a contract now. What am I going to do? I'm going to keep all this stuff now. Look, I'm going to make off like a bandit. V'ika hefsed meruba. What's going to happen? You're going to lose out on an immense amount of money. So he says, "Sarich she masne imagoy." You need to create what? A condition with the non-Jew. V'shiyomer lo ani makne lecha gam acheder bekesef zesha anas ata nosin li. Afo pishalo kasavti lecha shtar amachirazo. So what is he allowed to do? You can make a condition. This property will become yours, even though I haven't given you a shtar. Why you're allowed to do that? Because the rule is kol tanai shebamamon kayam, that basically when it comes to dealings of business, any rules that two parties want to make works, right? As long as there's money behind it, as long as it's enforceable by law, any rule that they make. Dekanle kedemashim b'choshim mishpat, so siman kav tzeri dalet. And he says, v'yei nizhar, he says, what do you need to do? You have to say that, shiomar kem b'tchila samekach. Right, you have to say right at the beginning, I am selling you this property on the condition that I don't need a shtar, even though usually you need a shtar. You have to say that because really, you should do it a shtar. And he says, from his perspective, that whole thing works. So Lamaisa, by the way, practically, we do a shtar. We do a contract when we sell chametz and also lease property under the chametz to the non-Jew. However, here you have the Bach, again, being very bold, taking a lot of halachic weight upon his shoulders and making what at the time was a fairly controversial decision on the sale of chametz. Okay, so that's one thing that comes up in the Bach there.
I don't see how that will solve the problem of the goy deciding he doesn't want to return it.
Because
he'll claim, psychologically he won't have a piece of paper. And
right. No, it's forget about psychologically. There, remember, the Vad Arba Artzos, there's a court that's enforceable, all this stuff is enforceable. So I could say to you, I'm selling you the property, and you're going to have a shtar now, and what are you going to do? You're going to go to court and have the Polish government enforce that document.
So all I'm saying is, eventually, if the goy claims that it's his...
So what can the Jew say?
The Jew will say, I deny it.
I deny it.
Then be lying.
No, it was a joke. I didn't merely mean it for more than... Okay, meaning you
it's more.
I agree with you that it's more psychological. The last thing we need is the guy going out there and doing all these things to prevent you from getting your property back.
Like we have in your shtar that he has to buy it back, you have to pay some.
So no, they didn't do that originally. That was a much later development in the what's it called, in the sale of chametz.
And this, let's say, when he did this first shtar, Rabbi the Bach, what town was it in?
Probably Krakow. Okay, I would just guess.
Did every rabbi hold by that?
No.
You can't even that guy's house.
So what's it called? So if you read some of the... So even though we don't have... There's no documents of this, but the feeling is amongst a lot of people that the reason the Bach had to move around as much as he did was because he, like I said, he wasn't afraid to take controversial halachic opinions, and like I said, he said what he was needed to say. He took his opinions, and if you criticize him, so be it. In that sense, he was very much like one of his real influences, Rav Shlomo Luria, the Maharshal, who also. The difference was is the Maharshal never had to move. The Maharshal was very much stayed where he was, and it seems like he had much more of a power base than the Bach did. So, from that perspective.
But the issue with this particular ruling is the acceptance of the community, because if other rabbis say it's not sufficient...
Right, it'll be Chametz Shavar Alav HaPetzach. Right,
so
right.
So, this is your business, and you're trying to sell the liquor for the next 30 days afterwards, it's a problem.
Right, so my hunch is... Right. Right. So my hunch is that in Krakow it probably carried more weight, where he was, you know, kind of the final word on that issue. The next issue that comes up that's also very important to us, and you don't realize how important it is, is the issue of Chadash and Yashan. So the Torah tells us that the wheat of this year is not permitted until the Korban HaOmer is brought, or the day of the Omer passes, which is the second day of Pesach. They would bring, actually, the night of the second day of Pesach, meaning Motzei Yom Tov in Eretz Yisrael. They would bring the Korban HaOmer, and after that, all new grain, all grain from that year, would be permitted. Okay, that was the statement. Okay? In this day and age, so officially, the rule should be that all grain of this year should be prohibited until after day two of Pesach. That should be, so day three of Pesach and on, we'd be allowed to eat what we call kemach chadash, or contemporary grain, for lack of a better word.
Is that conditioned on actually having the omer performed?
No. So even if you don't have a korban omer, then we say yom hanef, that day is the day we're allowed to do it, even though we don't have a korban omer. Otherwise, you'd never be able.
There's some items where because there is no actual omer, you're not obligated to.
No, we'll get to the Bach's opinion on that.
Okay.
All right, so. The Ramah paskins straight out in his Shulchan Aruch that Chadash Aser Min HaTorah, right? That contemporary grain is prohibited by biblical fiat. Okay, that is the position taken by the Ramah. Comes along the Bach in Yoredeya Siman Resh Tzadi Gimel, and he says, interestingly enough, also defending common practice. Which is, again, there's a long history of poskim, you know, going back all the way since Tosfos to defend common practice. But he says, Amnam, he says, nevertheless, Haminag Pashut b'malchutenu linohog heter. He says, but here in Poland, the common practice, he says, is that chadash we eat. Aye, it seems like a pasuk in the Torah. How do we allow you to eat contemporary grain if it's aser from the Torah? So he says, "Va'af gadole haTorah." He says, "Even great Torah scholars, Shayul Fanenu, Rav Shachna, the Maharshal, v'Talmidehem, lo hayu osrin v'shotin hasheichar." He says they didn't prohibit it, and how do I know? They would drink the alcohol, the beer, shenase mitvua shelo itiru haomer. He says they would drink the beer that was not allowed. For the Omer, Zulat Miktsas Chasidim, except for a small group of Chasidim. And here, just so you know what the word Chasidim means until the 19th century, Chasidim means people who take upon themselves stringencies. That's what Chasidim means, close to asceticism. So he says, except for a few, you know, crazies, Bekaro, Mikaro Nisaru Be'isr Zeh. And he says only a few like very very serious Chasidim, they were the ones who held it, but no one else held of it. V'ani b'mechorfi b'lamdi Maseches Kedushin. He says when I, you know, back in the day when I was learning Maseches Kedushin, Lifnei Shloshim Shana, he says about 30 years ago, Samti Alibi La'ayim Behorazu, I went to go research this Psak Halacha, V'ra'iti She'ina Halacha Psuka, and I saw that there is no clear decision over here. V'sha'alti Amor Gadol Mori V'rabi Liba Bar Betzalel. So he says, I went to my my great teacher, Liba Bar Betzalel, V'tzati Lefanav, and I suggested this statement that basically, what? Shaleti Mitzudatzi. What was his statement? His statement was, he says, in my opinion, he says, the reason that all of this, and he brings, you know, a list of proofs to it, my opinion, Chadash and Yashan don't apply outside of the land of Israel. It's a mitzvah tluya bar. It's a very, very bold opinion. Okay? And he says, I said it before, Rav Liba Bar Betzalel, he agreed, he didn't, oh, this is what he says, V'lo hayamisha sataris dvari, no one argued with me. Shtika koda adami, right? You keep your mouth shut, it means you agree. So therefore, he says, I think Yashan and Chadash doesn't apply, the prohibition of Chadash doesn't apply outside of the land of Israel. Very, very bold statement. Seemingly, it requires a little bit of halachic acrobatics to get to it, but that was his opinion. Why is this, you know, so bold? A, he takes on Rabban Shel Yisrael, the Rama himself, right? He has no qualms, you know, arguing with a straight-up psak and Rav Moshe Israelis in the Ramah. He's basing it on, notice, who does he mention here? The Maharshal, who was famous for attacking the Ramah. And this is consistent with the Bach's opinion, that codification, we don't do codification in our religion. The last thing that was codified was the Talmud. That's the only thing that can be codified. Okay, and it is the right of the posek to interpret the Talmud and paskin based upon his opinion. That's the Bach's opinion on that one. And so the Bach comes to the conclusion that Yashan, it does not apply outside of the land of Israel. So every time that you go out to a restaurant or you buy flour in the store and don't check the dates on the flour, you have to realize that you are not holding like the Ramah, like Rav Moshe Israelis, that you should realize that, you know, how many, what is it, oh, 500 years later, you are committing yourself to the very, very bold and, like I said, broad-shouldered psak of the Bais Chadash of Rav Yol Sirkis on that issue. So that's another issue. Again, another example of the Bach's kind of boldness in terms of the way he paskins halacha. Another one, interestingly, someone asked him about in instituting a cheirem, excommunicating an individual who had said some things anti-Kabbalah, anti-mysticism. You know, this is already, you know, you see a tshuva like this. This is in the Tshuvot Yeshanot of the Bach, Siman Hei. You see a tshuva like this, your ears perk up, because this is really interesting. This was seeming sent from the eastern lands. They had a shochet who had said something about bad things about Kabbalah. They wanted to excommunicate the shochet and stop accepting yeshrita. A lot of stuff that goes on. And the Bach supports the opinion that speaking inappropriately about Jewish mysticism, the Kabbalah in particular, is prohibited. And here the line in the Bach, Kach pasach biyoredeya, the kol shekein amal ig al divrei chachamim, says already we paskin in yoredeya. Here he's referring to the tour, that anyone who ridicules the words of chachamim, umidaber dofi al chachmas hakabbalah, the Bach's edition, and someone who speaks inappropriately about the wisdom of the Kabbalah, shehu mekor haTorah, that it is the source of Torah, the ikara kula, and the basis of all of it, yirat shamayim, of all fear of God, dechita, it is simple to me, dechayev nidoy, that he is liable in excommunication, de'im lecha mezalze b'divrei Torah, dechayev nidoy gadol mizeh. Says, how could you ever find a greater responsibility to excommunicate other than someone who ridicules the words of Torah? V'od halo nimshach achar philosophia. He says, and not only that, what makes him even worse, he's a follower of philosophy. And what is that? He minos ba'atzma. That is, you know, apostasy in its finest. V'isha azara she'izir ala Shlomo kamasha kasav, and that's what Shlomo HaMelech was talking about the isha azara that in Kohelet it's he says that matati li marmi mavet et ha'isha she'im etzodim charamim. It's not talking about actual women, but it's what's it talking about? It's talking about the following of philosophy. So what do we get from this Bach? So we get from this Bach a number of things. Number one, we get from him, he was a violent opponent of philosophy. Okay? In the tradition of the Maharshal, right? The Maharshal was also, you know, a great critic of Rav Moshe Isserles. The Bach followed in his criticism, and not only that, but he feels that someone who is Nimshach Achar Philosophia, that someone who is a follower of philosophy, I don't know how far this means. Does it mean he's reading the Mor Nevuchim? Does it mean he's reading Aristotle? What is?
I just can't say.
What? You know what? In those days, you know, there weren't accountants, there weren't lawyers, you know, so, you know, a shochet was a respectable position. You know, it didn't mean that, you know, it meant, I'm sure you had time to do things, other things in your time as well. But that's one of the interesting things. In terms of his being a proponent of Kabbalah, so Gershon Shalom, the great scholar of mysticism, so here he makes the claim that the Bach is reflecting a spirit of the time. Why is this important? Because right after, in the generation immediately following the Bach, towards the end of the 17th century, you're going to have the emergence of a character by the name of Shabtai Tzvi, who is speaking in the words of Lurianic Kabbalah. And basically, Shabtai Tzvi is going to be, at various points in time, encouraging a philosophy called antinomianism. Antinomianism is the rejection or transcendence of halacha in order to elevate the sparks and encouraging people basically to sin for the purposes of God. And Gershon Shalom is claiming that there was an undercurrent of Kabbalah, of mysticism, in pre-modern Polish Jewry, of which Sabbateanism grew out of. That is Gershon Shalom's claim. And one of his major proofs is this Bach. Moshe Idel, who's the current, I guess, expert on the history of mysticism, he teaches at the Hebrew University. I think for a while he was at UCLA also teaching there during one of his sabbaticals. But he rejects Shalom's claims. He says if you read the Bach carefully, the Bach is not an indicator that Kabbalah is, you know, all over the place. When he says Divrei Chachamim u'midaber dofri achochmat haKabbalah, it's clear that he's not referring only to Kabbalistic knowledge. He's mentioning Kabbalistic knowledge as something. So he says he's not so sure you can claim that Shabtai Tzvi was as organic. So this is just kind of an interesting debate of historians as to the influence of this Bach. In either case, I think you have here a fairly significant historical statement within the Bach in terms of his commitment to Kabbalah, his commitment to Halacha, and also his rejection of philosophy. Interestingly enough, there are a number of Bachs where he doesn't take mystical statements seriously when it comes to paskening halacha. When it comes to paskening halacha, he believes the tradition of psak outweighs, and he doesn't feel the necessity to defend Zohar practices in the same way, let's say, others would, like we saw the Rama of Fano defending practices within the Zohar and others, taking those positions. So the Bach was very much a halachist in those days, which again, undermines another claim that Gershon Shalom makes. Gershon Shalom likes to pit the mystics versus the halachists, you know, whereas the mystics are antinomian in nature, where they're transcending halacha and less focused on rigidity, whereas halachists are rejecting mystical thought and more focused on rigid halacha. Many of the great Kabbalists of our history were also the great halachists of our history. You know, let's start thinking. You know, sure, there's the Ari, who was no slouch when it came to halacha, but there was also Rav Yosef Karo, and one would not make the argument that he was not a halachist. The Ramban, who is the great promoter of halacha, of mysticism, of Kabbalah, and known as one of the people who really kind of popularized mystical learning was also one of the great halachic commentators in history, etc., etc. So the notion that antinomianism is by definition related to mystical thought is, I think Moshe Idel is very much right in that sense in debating Shalom's conclusions there. Okay, you had a question.
I'm just curious, since the Ramban was a philosopher, known as a philosopher, what's the attitude of all of these who object to philosophy to the psak given by the Ramban? Do they say, well, he's a philosopher, forget about him?
What, to the Ramban?
Ramban.
Oh, the Rambam.
Yeah, well, he was a philosopher.
So what's it called? There's a long history of ignoring sections of the Rambam.
That's what I thought.
Okay, there's a long history of that. You know, so you pretend like Sefer Mada starts with Hilchos Tshuva, you know what I mean, or Hilchos Deos.
That's a bold approach. Usually, if you object to someone whose mind has strayed and been influenced by philosophy and you have this view, you have to reject all the opinions of that person.
But they don't. And I think that path was kind of blazed by Nachmanides, the Ramban. In the way he dealt with the Maimonidean controversy of saying, like, you can disagree with parts of the Rambam, but not all of the Rambam, you know, taking that middle road in that. So he really blazed the path for halachists to follow to, you know, kind of deal with the, you know, the different personalities of the Rambam. The final issue that I'll deal with here is also an influential psak that was given by the Bach, again, testifying to the broadness or the breadth of his shoulders, is the Bach's decision regarding a particular aguna issue. The story goes, a kind of a tragic story of a man, a husband who disappeared, in the classic sense, but there were witnesses who did not see the dead body, but they saw him sink into a hole in the ice. And they wanted to know if she could remarry based on this witnessing that he has. And the Bach goes through, I'm not going to go through it just because I think I'm going a little longer than I expected, but the Bach goes through some of the various machinations that could come out in terms of whether we need to assume that he swam in the ice-cold waters under the hole to find a new hole, or whether you can count on the statements of A, Goyim, and B, two witnesses who saw him go down and never come up from any area wide, and that they claim that there was an expanse, that they would have been able to see him come out somewhere else. And the Bach takes the very bold statement of saying that the woman can remarry based on this witness. He was maligned for the position that he took, but to his credit, he stood his ground on this issue, and I think ultimately he won out in terms of being one of the great, proponents of the use of alternative forms of information in terms of to decide agunot. I know this opinion of the Bach was very much used when in decisions in 9/11 of whether to use genetic testing or DNA testing in order to decide if someone was dead or not. And because of that, the Bach was very much ahead of his time in terms of deciding those issues. The interesting statement that he makes, and again gets back to some of his mystical thought, is just how he ends it off in terms of those who want to take the more stringent opinion here. He says he believes that the desire for stringency, he says, is the fact that we are descendants, philosophical and physical descendants, of Hasidei Ashkenaz. Who are Hasidei Ashkenaz? So in the medieval period, the 12th and 13th century, there were a group of Ashkenazi pietists in the Germany and France area who were very mystical, not Zohar mystical, but their own form of mystical. And not only were they mystical, but they also happened to be Hasidim in the classical sense, in that they were very machmir, they were very stringent in terms of the way they interpreted halakha, and they were a bit ascetic as well in terms of their decisions. He says, "V'anachnu migeza Hasidei Ashkenaz." He says to them, "We are from the branch of Hasidei Ashkenaz." Darkenu shelo lehakel mida'at atzmenu. says it is our practice not to take leniencies willy-nilly. He says, therefore, I needed to explain in detail why, in this area, it is a simple issue. The question is, what does he mean when he says he considers himself from the branch of Hasidei Ashkenaz? Does that mean he believes himself to be mystic? Does he believe himself to be ascetic? Is there more of a mystical undercurrent of Hasidei Ashkenaz going through Poland? Or, more likely, and this is Dr. Soloveitchik's claim, it is posturing rather than sincere commitment to every word of Rav Yehuda HaChassid's Sefer HaChassidim. But it is just interesting to see, I guess from a medieval perspective, the influence of the work of the Sefer HaChassidim, you know, generations later in an entirely different area. You know, you're moving from the Western Europe all the way to Eastern Europe, but just to see how there was really that undercurrent of going on of those people who viewed themselves as very much the heirs of a certain era of Ashkenazi Jewry there in Poland. And we've spoken about that before, about how the Tosafist tradition, the Rashi tradition, and the Hasidei Ashkenaz tradition really emerges or reemerges in Poland later on. Okay, and that is, I guess, in a sense, the Bach. I think clearly his legacy is as a bold and creative posek, as someone who was willing to take on the major issues and to take controversial opinions. Whether those lost him his jobs in the rabbinate or not, again, is very speculative. But there certainly is the potential. One of the interesting things is he's not found on many of the statements of the Council of the Four Lands, which again you could make the argument that it was because of some of the more controversial opinions that he had taken over time. But again, it may have been just one of those things that he just wasn't in the right place at the right time to have ended up on any of them, or that we don't have the Pinkasim to record anything that he might have said on those issues. So that's the Bach in a nutshell.
Just, I don't understand this here, but he seems to imply that if you take on astringency, he says, does that mean that if he says it's okay and somebody comes and says, no, I don't do that, he is basically not only wrong, but he's committing some sort of a...
When it comes to heter agunot, so there's a lot of polemics that are going to go along, because remember, there's a lot at stake here. There's mamzerut at stake here. So he's basically saying, he's trying to cut off the competition of those who might, what he's saying is, if you decide to be stringent in this area, you're not using stringencies properly.
That's basically what he's saying. You're correct. Doing the wrong thing.
Exactly. Meaning, you want to be stringent, you know, have a bigger kiddush cup. You know what I mean? This is not the area that we want you to be stringent in.
Because it's a sort of bold statement saying, if you're full of it, don't do it.
Listen, every statement that he makes, I wouldn't say but he was someone who had big shoulders in terms of the way he paskened the halacha.
It's interesting, he apologizes towards the end. He said, well, I rely on two... Puskin and so forth, but
right.
Still an all.
Yeah, no, he knows what he's doing. Yeah. Alrighty. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.